tape is tape one of a recording of an interview with Dr. Delbert H. Meyer at his home on January 20th, 1997 by James G. Trainum. I know that you were born August 28, 1926. Can you tell me something about your parents and your childhood?
Let's see. My parents both had eighth grade educations. I was born on a farm in northeast Iowa. The farm had no running water, no electricity, and we did our farming through most of the years that I was with my parents by horses.
What were your father and mother's names?
My father's name was Henry, and my mother's name was Frida.
Had they always lived in Iowa, or had they moved here from somewhere else?
They had always lived in Iowa.
They must have given you considerable encouragement to proceed with education, since you indicated both of them only went through the eighth grade.
Well, not really. As a matter of fact, when I was going through high school, I didn't intend to do anything but farming. And then when I got out of high school, I was not quite 17 yet, and I wanted to join the Navy. And my parents didn't want me to join the Navy, so they said, why don't you go to college for a year, or before I do that. So that's how I got my start in college, and they did pay for my first year of college, which was, I think the total bill was like $450 for board, room, tuition, and all the fees, and spending money and everything.
You say you went 1 year to college. Did you then go into the Navy?
Yes, then I joined the Navy, spent 2 years in the Navy, and when I got out of the Navy, I still had intended to farm, but by the time I got out, I was one of the last ones to be let out of the Navy, and all the farms were either rented or sold by that time, so I happened to be visiting my sister, who was in the same town that I'd gone to college in. I went up there, and person in charge of being students said, met me in the hall and said, aren't you coming back to college? And I said, well, it's too late to join now, isn't it? It was like the second week in August or something like that. He says, well, not if you've got a place to stay. And I was telling my sister this after I got back, and she said, well, why don't you can stay with us? And so that's how I went back to college. Good. On the GI Bill.
What was it in college that turned your interest from farming to chemistry?
Well, when I went to college, I hadn't really planned on going, and so I, when I decided to go, I went and saw the high school superintendent and asked him, I said, what do you think I could do? He looked at my records and said, well, he said, you know, one of the things you could do is engineering, because I was pretty strong, my math background was strong in high school, and so I had started out in electrical engineering curriculum at Wartburg. And the second year of that, when I got back, I had to take chemistry. And I had never had any chemistry before, and never even thought about it. And I ran up against this course in which Professor Swenson made the course very challenging, and I was really doing badly after the first 6 weeks. And I finally caught up with all the kids that had high school chemistry, and wound up getting an A for the semester. Plus, it seemed like it was interesting, and the way he taught it was to solve problems. And I enjoyed solving problems, and so that's, you know, I talked to him after that first semester and said, do you think I can still get a major in chemistry? And he said, yeah, we'll work it out. So that's how I got into chemistry.
How large was your class?
In high school?
In that chemistry class.
I think there actually were two sections, so there were probably 25 to 30 students.
Mm-hmm. So you had the opportunity to have a good bit of interaction with the professor.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you go to high school in Maynard?
Yes.
And they gave you a good map preparation there.
Yeah, we had a particular teacher who was, I look back on it and I wonder how he did all the things he did, because he was really the band instructor. And he had the junior high band, the senior high band, he taught instruments to something like 70 or 80 students. And then he taught three math classes on top of that. And in our senior year, three of us decided we would like to have something a little more challenging in math than what they had offered, so we went down and talked to the superintendent about getting geometry. And he says, well, we'll set it up as a correspondence course, and then we'll just have Mr. Ellingson give you guidance on it. Well, the word got out, and we wound up with 15 students, so Mr. Ellingson took on another class. And his classes were a lot like his band. They would get noisy up to the point where he thought it was too loud, and then he'd just kind of say something, and they'd quiet back down. But he made learning such a fun experience that I think you just couldn't help but do well. And as a matter of fact, in that course in geometry, nobody got less than a C, and really, everybody really deserved it.
It sounds as though you were unusually fortunate in having inspiring teachers both in high school and at Wartburg College.
Yeah, I would say so. We also had a coach at Maynard who taught history, and of course that was right just during the period when World War II was starting up, and we'd always start with maybe 10 or 15 minutes of discussion of the headlines of the day, and he had a way of taking that and bringing it into his history class and making you think about what history was about and so on. So I think it was just very good. And then our school superintendent taught agriculture class, and I don't know that I learned much about agriculture, but I learned a lot about organization of thinking and that sort of thing. So I really some excellent teachers, even though Maynard was a very small school. I think we had 16 teachers for the whole high school.
So you were in effect committed to a chemistry major after your first course in chemistry, is that correct?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you proceeded on to a major in chemistry. When did you make the decision to go to graduate school?
Well, when I was getting my bachelor's degree, which is in 49, there had been so many the veterans that had gone to school on GI Bill and were graduating about the same time, and had graduated, so a lot of them had graduated a couple of years later. So the field of chemistry was really full in the industries. So there weren't many jobs available, so I decided with the guidance of Professor Swenson that I should go on and get a graduate degree in chemistry. So that's how I made my decision to go into graduate school.
Where did you go to graduate school then?
I went to the University of Iowa, which was a recommendation of Dr. Swenson, who had also gone there, and he knew some of the professors, which I think was of some help to me later on in choosing who I worked for and that sort of thing.
Did you consider any other universities for graduate study, or just centered in on Iowa?
I just centered in on it and went there.
Tell me something about your graduate school experiences.
Well, again, I really had no intention of going on for a doctor's degree. I was just going to get a master's degree and go work. My wife and I had gotten married after I'd gotten a bachelor's degree. She'd gotten her degree then at the same time. And but by the time I was going to get my master's degree, things still hadn't opened up in the job field. And I was talking to my advisor about this, what I could do, and he said, well, why don't you go out and just forget getting a master's and just go out and get your doctor's degree. And I said, well, do you think I've got enough to do that? And he said, well, what are your grades? And I told him, and he said, yeah, I think you do. And so that's how I decided to go right on for getting a PhD right from a bachelor's degree.
When did you begin your doctoral research?
I'm not sure, but I think it was the second semester of my first year.
Okay. With whom did you work?
Well, this was again, I had two choices in organic chemistry that Professor Swenson had suggested, I think. One was Dr. Ralph Schreiner, and the other was Stanley Wozniak. And Dr. Schreiner was, he limited how many graduate students he had, so he was filled up with his limit, and so I went to work for Dr. Wozniak then.
What was the area of your research with him?
Well, when I started out, I was going to work on theophylline derivatives, which are central nervous system stimulants. He was had some association with Smith, Klein, and French at that time, and was interested in synthesizing new drug materials. And that's where I started out. And the project I had worked on, a couple of other people had worked on, and it was one of those where you bumped your head against a stone wall. And so that's where I was at the end of my, about first year, I guess, of research.
But you changed the topic then?
Yeah, I went to we went to a seminar one day, and somebody was talking about illids and that kind of chemistry. And Dr. Wozniak said, well, as we went back to our offices, he says, why don't you think about trying to make an amine imid, which is a nitrogen with a positive charge on one nitrogen and a negative charge on the other. And so I went to the literature, and there wasn't really a lot in the literature on it. At least, as a matter of fact, from my searching, I never did find that anybody had ever made a stable amine imid. It's like the tautomer of hydrazine. And so I went to work and tried to synthesize one of those, and that's what I did for my doctoral thesis. And I synthesized one compound and characterized it. That was it. And no one really was able to use that technique to synthesize another analog. In organic chemistry, once you synthesize one, and then those days anyhow, you synthesized a whole family of them. Well, no one was able to do that. And later on, somebody else synthesized another one with a different technique, and finally, the third student found a more general synthetic method, and it grew to a pretty good sized field. And the last I knew, in 1980, I think Dr. Wozniak wrote a review article in which there were 180 papers and patents that had issued on that topic. So I guess you feel kind of neat that you at least opened up another field for other people to explore it.
Yes, I'm sure that was interesting and satisfying to have done. Well, once you finished that dissertation and received your doctoral degree, what did you do then?
Well, by the time I was getting ready to look for a position, the industrial field had opened up, and I had opportunities at that time to interview 26 companies, and I narrowed it down to 10, and then I added two more to it. One because the one company had given me a fellowship, and I figured I just had to give them the right to take a look at me and me at them. And then the other one, the interviewer came through, and he made his company sound so outstanding that you felt you just had to go and see whether it was really hot air or whether he really knew what he was talking about. So then I went out and interviewed these 10 companies, and eventually elected to work for Standard Oil of Indiana at that time.
What was it that persuaded you to choose that one among all the others?
Well, they were starting a new, well, I had been in the process of starting a new group in petrochemical research, and I thought that sounded like it would be pretty interesting. And they were more in the Midwest. I had spent one summer working for DuPont while I was at the University of Iowa in their Wilmington research area. And although I very much enjoyed working for DuPont, I didn't care for the Wilmington area at all. And they did make me an offer for Waynesboro, Virginia, but I eventually decided that Standard Oil was the place I wanted to go work for.
So it was a combination of the work that you were going to be associated with and the geographical location that persuaded you that Standard Oil of Indiana was the place for you.
Well, it was at least the work I perceived I was going to be doing. And I thought at that time that I wanted to do more exploratory type research, and I thought that I had that kind of opportunity to work for Standard Oil. And turned out, I later found out I really wasn't prepared to do that kind of totally independent research at that point in my career.
Well, what did you move into then?
Well, I actually did work in exploratory research for the first 2 years I worked for Amoco, or for Standard. And then they had come to an agreement with Scientific Design to look at oxidation technology to make aromatic carboxylic acids with the cobalt, manganese, and bromine catalyzed system. At that point, everything was clouded in secrecy. And they needed more people to work on that project, and they asked me if I would work on that, and I had realized that I wasn't making very much progress working on the projects I had been, so I transferred over to that project probably 1955, I guess it was. So I'd worked about 2 years in what I call probing or exploratory kind of research, and then moved to looking at development kind of research.
Well, apparently it turned out to be a very astute move.
Well, it turned out for a couple of reasons. Again, I think in my career, I look at it, I'm not sure how much native talent I had. I needed a lot of help. And my first supervisor I had at Standard Oil was not the kind of person that I needed to supervise me. And I moved from him to another supervisor who wasn't afraid to tell the story like it was, and he called me in, closed the door, and said, "Oh, this is your last chance." And I had no idea I was in that kind of situation. But then he went on and said, "Now, this is what I want you to do." And so he gave me a lot of guidance, and the real problem was I wasn't very productive, and I hadn't done nearly as many experiments kind of thing as I should. So he just kept throwing me stuff to do, and encouraging me to keep up with it. One day I was getting frustrated because I thought I just had too many things to do, and I looked. So I sat down and counted it up, and I had 10 projects he had me working on at that time. And so I walked into his office and said, "Which 6 of the 10 would you like me to really work on?" And I think the thing that convinced me of was that I'd finally gotten my confidence. And a lot of the stuff I was doing was analytical research, physical chemical research. I had an analytical minor at Iowa when I was there, so that was kind of natural. But the physical chemistry research was my weakest field. And I did quite a bit of physical property measuring, things like vapor pressure, solubility, that kind of thing. And then in the early stages, part of what I was doing was looking at how to separate. We were oxidizing the mixed xylenes and then separating all the acids. And so I spent a lot of time on how to separate them and how to analyze the materials that we were separating and how to get rid of the impurities, that kind of thing.
Did you turn up any previously untried ways of separating the isomers that were obtained from the oxidation?
But not commercially acceptable ways. Isophthalic and terephthalic acid were the two that were the most difficult to separate, because they wound up just about in any solvent you looked at, they would dissolve at about a 12-to-1 ratio. It was a 8-to-1 ratio, because it was 88-12. And so then you just couldn't separate them. There were a couple of ways you could get them at 96-4 or something like that, but they weren't really clean-cut methods. And we found that, Jim Roblock and I found that you could actually separate them using a pyridine solvent in which the isophthalic was less soluble than the terephthalic in that particular situation, so you could then separate it back and forth. Turns out that I think, and I did do some work on this, but I wasn't the one who discovered it, but one of our engineers found out that the isophthalic acid would grow larger size crystals than terephthalic acid. And you had to crystallize in the right way. You had to nucleate and then grow the crystals fairly carefully. And then if you did that, you could get a 95-96% separation by just separating them on the basis of particle size. And that's how we actually eventually separated diso and terephthalic acid.
How did you separate the particles on particle size? Surely you didn't have to use tweezers as Pasteur did.
No, I used a door clone, which was you put it through and it was separated them on the basis of centrifugal force. And but you had to, the interesting thing that in order to test this, you had to actually have the door clone the same size as a commercial material. And 500 gallons was enough for a 30-second test. So it did work. And it wasn't as good of a commercial process as you would have liked, because to get the best kind of crystal growth, you had to remove some of the impurities by carbon treatment first. And then the nucleation period was longer than you would like for a commercial process. It just took too long. And but eventually we did make a product that was about 96% pure.
Nearly all of the accounts of your research career emphasize your discovery of a particular good way of purifying terephthalic acid. Was this the way that you are famous for doing, or was there a later development?
No, that was certainly the thing that was the most probably commercially significant discovery I made. I also invented the Amoco's process eventually to make dimethyl terephthalate. I made that first, because that was our entry. That was the only material that was used for polyester at the time. And so I had invented that process. And that was kind of an interesting thing, too, because we were having difficulty really developing any kind of technique for making it on the basis of the experimentation we were doing. And we were wondering one day what happened to the catalyst of the system. And we had been doing sealed tube solubility techniques for determining solubility of the various acids in the acetic acid and water and all those mixtures. And my boss said, well, why don't we see if we can use that technique to find out if it was soluble. And we did, and the glass blower told me that these sealed tubes I was using were good for 5,000 pounds. Turned out later I found out they were maybe good for 100. But they did last. 8 out of 9 would withstand the 2,000 pounds or whatever it is we wound up with. And anyhow, once we got looking at that, we said, well, that would be a good technique to study the esterification, because you could get them up to temperature in 2 minutes and then run them for whatever period of time you wanted and cool them off in 2 minutes. So you could actually get kinetic rate studies, whereas in an autoclave that it took you a half an hour to heat it up and a half an hour to cool it down, you just couldn't do that. And so in doing this, I found out that esterification didn't take place if you went through the critical zone. Methanol critical temperature was at 240, and we were trying to run the esterification at 260. And if you went through that too fast, it didn't make enough dimethyl terephthalate to provide a liquid phase, you got no esterification. So that was really the basis of the invention then, that you had to have some DMT in the process to make it. And we could. That's how we actually got into the polyester feedstock business. And then, even in those days, in 1956, it just seemed foolish to go through all that process if we could purify TA directly. And our terephthalic acid that we made by our oxidation process was a lot more pure than that was made by the nitric acid process. The material I got from nitric acid oxidation was a little better than 90% pure. It was aqua colored, and had nitro compounds in it, oxidation intermediates, whereas ours was just mainly oxidation intermediates and a little bit of tannish color to it. And so that gave us hope for maybe we could purify it. Because with the TA, with the DMT, you had to make the ester. You sent the ester to the polymer people, and they polymerized it, got methanol, which was impure. We got the methanol back, had to purify it. So we went through a lot of steps, whereas if we could purify the TA directly by some simple way, that looked like a lot better way to go.
And the pyridine solubility was your way of purifying it?
Well, to start with, no. One of the real problems, of course, with terephthalic acid is that its good property was, which in polyesters, which it has high temperature properties, it gave fibers the ability to have permanent press in natural way, had a high enough melting point so that you wouldn't melt it with an iron and so on. Was also a negative from the standpoint of processing, is that terephthalic acid didn't melt, and it had very low solubilities. At 200 degrees C, it still was only 1% soluble in solvents like water or acetic acid, which we felt we had to be able to use in order to be economical. And so our first experiments were actually done with sodium hydroxide. We had at Amoco the ability to do 10%, what we call 10% time experiments. And so I guess somewhat due to my encouragement, a lot of people were doing 10% time experiments on how to purify terephthalic acid. And one of my colleagues actually found that with treating it with dissolving it in base first, and then treating it with chlorine, which is really hypochlorite, and then carbon treating it, you could make nice looking terephthalic acid.
Exactly what do you mean by 10% experiment that you were talking about?
Well, that meant that we could use 10% of our time, in theory, to do any experiment on anything we wanted to. Was our choice. Now, it was, if you wanted to get credit for that, of course, you wanted to choose something that maybe the company was interested in or would be interested in. I have quite a few 10% experiments that didn't work out very well, and they stayed in the notebook. But I also had a lot of other 10% experiments that did get known by the company. But anyhow, he was able, and Al Hensley was able to purify terephthalic acid, and we had set that we had to have a material that was as pure as DMT, dimethyl terephthalate, and that was 99.97% by cryoscopic purity measurements. And since you couldn't do that with, you couldn't melt terephthalic acid, you couldn't get purity that way, we analyzed for all the impurities and subtracted from 100 and hoped that we had analyzed for enough to get there. And anyhow, this material that we made by this salt chloride treating process gave us material that was in that range of purity.
And that was satisfactory for direct use in the polymer production?
Well, we thought it was good enough, and so we made 1,000 pounds of material and sent it to our DMT customers, and they looked at it and came back to us and said that it just didn't make high enough molecular weight. So I was talking with my lab guy who had the lab next to mine, and he was a polymer expert. He made the polyethylene terephthalate from the DMT to measure our quality. So he knew how to make polymer from DMT, and I knew how to esterify from my work on making DMT, so I figured out what kind of conditions we need to run to make ester from terephthalic acid and ethylene glycol, and then he would take it over from there. And so for the first experiment, I made the pre-polymer and handed it over to him, and we had decided to really load up the material with the best catalyst we could think of, and quite a large amount, in order to get the molecular weight up. Well, we went through it, And these were run in glass tubes, and you broke the glass tube. And as a matter of fact, when the polyester cooled off, it just pulled the glass away from the inside of the glass tube you're in. Then you break the tube. Then you drill it for a piece of material so that you can measure the molecular weight by intrinsic viscosity. And on that particular sample, we couldn't even drill it. It was so hard. So we never found out what the molecular weight was. So in our second experiment, we backed off to normal catalyst, normal amounts, and we made material that was the same molecular weight as you made from DMT. And then we went out and got a 100% polyester shirt, background shirt. They were pretty awful things because they were slimy and they got gray looking when you wore them. But we thought that at least we got 100% polyester. We'll compare the color of that with the color of the polymer we made. As near as we could tell, it was the same color. So we concluded then that that was indeed a good material for making, that you could indeed make polyester from terephthalic acid. My colleague in this was Paul Mahalson, and on the basis of those two experiments, we got a patent on how to make polyester from TA. And one of the claims that the attorney put in it was that intermediate that I gave to Paul Mahalso. And I'm not certain, but I think just about anybody that makes polyester goes through that intermediate, with PTA, goes through that intermediate. So it seems that at least nobody ever sued for infringement of our customers, sued the others for infringement of their processes. And so I think that at least this was enough to muddy the waters enough so that they wouldn't do that. So I think that in addition to proving to ourselves that polyester really could be made this way, it also decreased the possibility that our customers would sue one another for infringement on their processes.
And this process became a major operation for Amoco, didn't it?
Yes, but not right away. We ran that experiment in 1958, and not much really happened for the next 3 years, except for an occasional 10% time experiment when somebody got an idea of how they thought they could purify terephthalic acid. And in 1961, actually a couple of customers came back to our marketing people and said they wanted to go into the polyester business big, but they wanted to do it different from DuPont, and they wanted to do it with PTA. And then we were sitting there with that salt process, which, number one, was about equivalent in economics or worse than DMT. And number two is you'd make a whole bunch of salt that you had to get rid of. And the only way of getting rid of the salt was to pour it down a deep well. And even in those days, for environmental reasons, we didn't want to do that. So we set up then a group of three of us to look for a commercial acceptable way of making purified terephthalic acid. And of course, the tendency always is to go with what you know. And we divided up the areas, and one of my colleagues thought the best way would be to just improve our oxidation process, and which was a very good idea. But he also had the responsibility for looking at hydrogen treatment. And I looked at how could you recycle a salt in the hypochlorite carbon treating process. And although there were some ideas on how to do it, none of them really worked very well. They were just, you could do it, but it just didn't. It wasn't amenable very to commercial techniques. And I looked at lots of other kinds of things. And another colleague of mine was, he was working mainly on, we had to make 1.5 million pounds of this salt process for our customers to develop their techniques. And he had the responsibility for that, plus some other approaches.
Well, after I had looked at lots of different approaches and everything was failing and not doing very well, I went to the other colleague in the group and said, how about hydrogen treatment? Would you mind if I looked at that? He says, no, not at all, but he says, it won't work. He says, it won't work because you'll reduce the benzene ring. And that set a requirement on the system then. So I went back and looked at the major impurity we had to get rid of was the aldehyde acid, which was an oxidation intermediate. And the problem with it was that it formed a constant, it formed a solid solution with the terephthalic acid, so you couldn't separate it. So we had to convert it to something else in order to make it separation. And I had always thought that the easiest way to do it was by oxidation, but it in any of either acetic acid or water, you just could not oxidize that aldehyde down. It would oxidize extremely slowly at best, and then it seemed to me it was almost like it was an inorganic, not a catalytic, but a stoichiometric reaction with the material you thought was your catalyst. So when you looked at the materials that were best catalysts for hydrogenation with of aldehydes and not reduced benzene rings, nickel and kieselguhr looked like the best catalyst. So we got some nickel and kieselguhr and set up and ran the first experiment. We got my technician was very good at scrounging equipment, and he got a big rocking autoclave, and we set up and ran the experiment, and it had no cooling in it, so you had to wait overnight for it to cool down. And we opened it up the next morning, and boy, were we disappointed. Everything was green, and it just didn't look very nice. But he was pretty stubborn, and he says, let's analyze it. So we had some analytical tools to analyze for aldehyde acid. Boy, the aldehyde acid was gone. And there wasn't much cyclohexane products. And he said, well, why don't we get rid of that green stuff, which was the nickel, of course, had dissolved from the kieselguhr. And so we washed it with nitric acid and some acetic acid, cleaned it up. And it was nice and white-colored looking material. So although we had been chemically successful from an industrial standpoint, we actually set another requirement, and that was that the catalyst had to be resistant to the corrosive nature of the terephthalic acid solution, which really was quite corrosive when you got up to the temperatures we were talking about, which is 240 degrees centigrade. At 240 degrees centigrade, you get a 10% solution, and our economics people thought maybe working with 10% solution would be okay. So the next best catalyst was palladium on carbon, and a lab partner that was next door to me had been working on decarbonylation of aldehyde ester for purifying DMT. And so he had palladium on carbon, and so he loaned me some catalyst and repeated the experiment. Next morning when we opened the reactor, it was crystals, must have been half an inch to an inch long, nice white colored crystals. And we analyzed those, and again, the aldehyde was gone, and there was very little cyclohexane formed. And the when we measured the color of the terephthalic acid, it was in the right range, and we said, well, that's pretty good. About 3 days later, the head of the research department walked by, and we called him in and said, we've discovered the PTA process. And, we were a little bit joking about it, but actually, 2 months after we ran the first experiment, we decided that was the process we were going with commercially. And we got together with the Abaco oil engineers, and my friend who had been working on making the 1.5 million pounds by the salt process, they set the design basis for the process, and by June had the commercial process designed, and we went in to the Amoco management and asked for the money for the first plant, and 40 million pound a year plant, and John Swinton said yes. After he asked, could you sell the product, and the marketing guy says, well, if they can make it, I can sell it. And so in 1965, the first commercial plants started, 40 million pounds a year. And by 1970, we had 400 million pounds a year capacity. And then during the 70s, it continued to grow extremely. You grew for 10 years at 10%, at 33% a year. So it was just unbelievable growth. Turns out that we gave some benefits to our customers. We sold them the terephthalic acid at the same price they were buying the DMT, which meant they got 17% more for the same amount of money. And an area that we didn't really know about is that the polymerization took about 15-20% less time when you started with the acid than the ester, because you never quite got rid of all the ester groups, so that the reaction between the transesterification reaction was slower than the esterification reaction, so you got just a little bit more. And when you're talking about at the end, when you're finishing off a polymerization, that's a real reduction, and so it made it a lot cheaper than to make the polyester that way.
So from that hydrogen treatment process came the very successful Amoco process for producing purified terephthalic acid.
Yes.
Is that development the one that in your career was largely responsible for your receiving the Perkin Medal?
As a matter of fact, almost entirely, I think. I did some other things that were important too. I think it's important to say that there were some other things that made the PTA process really work well too, is that when we first started, we moved so fast that everything was batch technology. And in 1962, we finally got to the point where we could oxidize terephthalic acid, paraxylene continuously terephthalic acid. So you had the process that we wound up with is you fed paraxylene into a reactor, you separated the terephthalic acid out, you fed it continuously through the PTA reactor and separated it out, so you essentially had this one smooth, continuous process, except you did have a separation step in the middle. So it was an extremely simple process in the end, and which meant good economics. The other thing that I think is important to point out is that none of the oxidation technology would probably have been successful, at least as successful commercially, if it hadn't been for the rocket science that was going on. The need in the rocket industry for titanium metallurgy was very important, and our oxidation technology required corrosion-resistant materials. And it turned out that although Haskell-IC was fairly good, it developed leaks fairly frequently. As a matter of fact, our Joliet plant got so good they could change out a reactor in 24 hours and have it set up. So you know that we changed out a lot of reactors. Titanium came along and it resisted the corrosion. And it's been very important. We don't have to change out reactors, that kind of thing. The titanium reactors last very, very long time. And so it was in a large respect, I think, due to the development of titanium metallurgy for the rocket science that our technology has been commercially successful. Matter of fact, the first 8 commercial chemical reactors ever made with titanium were made for our oxidation process.
Amoco was not involved in the titanium research itself, was it? They just used it?
Well, I think, I don't know just how much our metallurgists were involved. We certainly set the requirements for what a reactor would have to be, but it was the metallurgy people themselves that eventually developed the technique. They actually put titanium in a stainless steel shell, and in this way they were able to reduce the amount of titanium that was needed, and you also got the strength of the stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
At the temperatures we were operating, titanium might not have been quite strong enough. Okay.
Oh, no, no, that's going very well, I think, and I'm glad you're revealing the mixture of experiences you had in the research you were doing, because that's the way, of course, research really goes. Let me ask you about your movement during this time into research management. You have indicated a little bit about it, but can you give any more details about what appealed to you, your management style?
Well, I guess I was never sure whether I was really management or not. I liked certain aspects of management, but obviously I enjoyed the research end. But I thought I really wanted to give management a try. And in 1966, I got that opportunity, and so I took it, and I managed the group actually that I had been working in, and so I was responsible for really the tech service of the PTA. We did the R&D did the tech service on PTA, the quality problems. So and if there were any manufacturing problems, we worked with our manufacturing people. So I was responsible for that, and it was a great experience because I went along with the marketing people to our customers, and we went R&D and marketing, sat down and tried to resolve whatever problems came up, and we were always very honest with our customers about what went on. And our customers, even though sometimes our customers didn't believe we were being honest with them, we would tell them what was going on, and could try to work to solve the problems. And I think in the end, working with our customers that closely gave R&D a very good picture of what our customers needed in way of product quality. And it turns out it isn't absolute quality that's as important as having the same quality all the time. Because the real problem with polyester quality was in the dyeing of the material. Or even the white shirt, the eye can perceive fairly small changes going from white to a little bit yellowish and back. And what was really dramatic in some of our customers' cases was when they put dye into the material. They could have red dye at times, and the same material, same threads, apparently would come out looking light pink. And so constant quality between both the PTA quality and the way that the polyester manufacturer made his material was really very important in working with them. And I think by being honest with our customers, we developed a high degree of credibility and mostly a very good working relationship with our customers. Matter of fact, we spent a lot of time
working on setting the specifications for PTA when we started. And one of the people that we dealt with, my marketing colleague, told me one day, to know him is to hate him. Well, I got to know him later on, and it turns out that he really was a pretty nice guy, but he was just being tough. And when we set those requirements and the specifications, they stayed until just a few years ago when we got both better analytical techniques and techniques for making the polymer and finding out really what chemistry was important, what impurities were important in making polymer and so on. So that those specifications, although they were derived at in what I would call maybe struggling negotiations, by being tough with us, he created, I think, specifications which were very good for us and for the industry, and they held up for a very long time, and mostly they're still in place. Let's see, I got diverted back.
I was just asking about your management experiences, and that's part of it. Anything else to add to your portion of your career when you were in management?
Well, after I'd been in this field for about, I guess it was 71, so that would be 6 years. You know, I had spent from 55 to 71 essentially in the same field. I had also worked with our development of our trimolytic anhydride technology, and I had done some with our isophthalic technology, but mostly it was with purified terephthalic acid and trimolytic anhydride. And I decided maybe it was time to do something different, and so I asked my boss if there was an opening in an area where they were working on developmental products. And I said, well, you know, would you like to consider me for that position? And so it was a sideways move, and he was very anxious to do it, and so we made that move. And then I spent most of the rest of my career just working on new product development, exploratory research, that kind of thing.
Tell us something about that. What particular product development were you most associated with?
Well, nothing that I worked with actually ever became commercialized. And I think partly it was because Amoco was growing so fast with the products they had that nobody was very interested in taking the risks of going with new products. And I think the other thing that was a problem was that the relationship between the marketing people that we were supposed to be supporting and us was less than satisfactory. They would be very encouraging at the start of a project, and about halfway through, just when you were starting to spend big money on it, they would say, oh, I don't think we know about this yet. They really hadn't done their homework. I guess I shouldn't really talk too much about that. It just was a... We never got a team work together that really said what we ought to be doing. Now, management, I think, on the other hand, upper management, really wanted us to come up with new products. And they kept giving us money to spend as long as we came up with ideas. And R&D was coming up with lots of ideas, but the business and the marketing aspects of them had not been tested fully enough, I think. And so, but they didn't say no, and so management kept giving us more opportunity to do things. And so we had a lot of fun, and we had a lot of successful research that was unsuccessful from a commercial standpoint, which is one thing that just drives you nuts when you're in that business, because you don't just want to have successful technical research. You want your research to go commercial. That's really the reason you're in business in the industrial atmosphere. And after I had spent a fair number of years there, as a matter of fact, I became a director. We grew from, I think we started out, we had about 4 people, and we probably grew to 120 professionals in doing that kind of work. I had decided that I really wasn't cut out to manage that kind of work the way they wanted it managed, and so I asked to get back to the technical ladder, and they moved me back to the technical ladder for my last 2.5 years, which was a lot of fun, really, because I could talk to scientists and advise them from a technical standpoint. And once they realized I wasn't part of management anymore, then they finally would start talking to me, and you know, not everybody would open up, but they were enough to open it up, so it was a very enjoyable thing. And in addition, I looked at lots of, not lots, but a number of technologies from outside Amoco, and evaluated them for the company to see whether we ought to pick them up or not, working with government labs, universities, and that kind of thing.
Was there any particular project during that last 2.5 years that you enjoyed above others?
Well, yeah, we had a project on making pyramethyl styrene going, and one of the problems in dehydrogenation was that you could get isopropyl styrene, which was really bad, costly, and that sort of thing. And I found a way of selectively hydrogenating that material and getting rid of it. So it gave me the sense that after 20-some years of management, I could still go back to R&D and do it. So that, from that standpoint, it was very desirable, enjoyable.
Well, Amoco chose to recognize and honor your career with an award, I believe. Tell us something about that.
Well, in 1989, the VP of Research invited me out to lunch one day, and I had a meeting that afternoon that I had to make a presentation at, so he had asked me if I wanted a drink with the meal, and I said no. I said, I got to give a talk this afternoon, I said. And he sat down and told me that the company was going to honor me with an award, which, you know, and well, that's nice. And then he's told me that they were also going to give me $150,000, and Amoco had never given anybody that I knew of that kind of money for anything. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he says, I thought I should have encouraged you. Try that drink. But they did. They had a nice award party, and it was a fun bash.
I'm sure it was. What was the name of the award?
William M. Burton Award. Mr. Burton was the person responsible for developing cracking of hydrocarbons to gasoline, kerosene, and he and Humphreys, I think, was kind of the, whether they were co-inventors or what, but they had been responsible for this cracking material, and they were the last people that had gotten an award like this in the company, and that was probably in the, I don't know, 19. In the teens or 20 or something like that. And so I'm really the only person in the company that's gotten this award so far. And they're looking, I guess, for other people now that are deserving of the award.
And you received another major recognition from President Bush, I believe.
Yeah, I got the National Medal of Technology from Department of Commerce, and it was handed out by President Bush in the Rose Garden, and I think that was 92. And that was an experience. That was a 3-day bash, and they allowed us only two guests, so we have five children, and so it was kind of difficult to make a choice on which of the two of the five we should invite along. But we invited the two boys who were kind of in the chemistry field, and we all had a good time in Washington.
Well, as a result of your experience with Amoco, spent your entire career with one company, very happy choice for you there at the beginning of your career. As a result of your experience with it, what does scientific innovation mean to you?
Well, I think you need to have a need for a product in the marketplace. I think it was one of the most important things. Early when we were, before we had even heard of scientific designs technology, we had Dr. Herman Mark as a consultant. And he had pointed out to us that from all the synthetic fibers, that polyester was the best combination, had the best combination of properties to be a successful synthetic fiber. So we started out, I think, with the idea that here was a product that, if you could make it right, was going to be a successful product. And then we had the raw materials. We had a management commitment. John Swearingen had said he wanted the company to be 10% of the chemicals to be 10% of the Amoco Corporation's income by 1970. This was in the mid, he became chairman about 1957 or 8, somewhere like that. So it gave us 12 years to go from 50 million to 2 billion every minute. So I think you need to have the right kind of marketplace. You've got to have a vision of what that product is going to be, and then you have to have the means to make it. I think you have to have a marketing group that works with the customers to find out what the customers really need, and to then make the product that they need, not the product you want to make necessarily. And then you've got to price the materials such that the be able to price them such that the end consumer will buy them and use them.
And the company still makes some profit.
Oh yes. Yes, you gotta have that profit margin in there, otherwise you give up on it. The question is, you know, in our case, these were really terrific unknowns. I think one of the other things is the willingness to take risks is so important, and I see that as a very difficult thing for corporate managers today. There's so much heat from the Wall Street people that it's difficult for a chairman or president of a subsidiary or anything to make a decision to go with new technology that hasn't been proven and where there isn't a market proven. In our case, we went 6 months after the invention was made. We made the decision to be commercial and what technology we were going to use. We hadn't done the pilot planning. We made the pilot, built the pilot plants and had them running shortly after and showed indeed that the technology would work. But I think you've got to have the ability and the willingness to take the risks. The ability, you've got to be able to lose the money and not go broke. One company did that. They went with technology and it didn't work and they went broke. They just overextended themselves. So you've got to be able to take the risks. And then I think you've got to have faith that things are going to work out and the commitment to make things work if they can work.
You made reference a little earlier in discussing the latter part of your career to scientific teamwork, and it was implied in much earlier in your description of your career. What's your comments about scientific teamwork in an industrial environment?
Well, there's no question in my mind that without it, things don't work. At least they work extremely difficultly. Now we have all kinds of organization techniques to try to set up situations so that you do indeed have teamwork. I think basically all these things do is try to emulate what we did back in those early days. You know, we were a small group of people. There were three scientists, one design engineer in research. There were probably three people in marketing, and then the associated management people. That was our team. And we also knew that if we didn't get with PTA, Amoco Chemical might not survive. And so there was a strong desire to make this thing work. And based on that, people just worked together. And it wasn't that there weren't at times some rubbing of the edges of personalities, but everybody realized that we wanted to work together to make this thing go. And I know from an R&D standpoint, we would do anything that marketing asked to make the project a success, or that engineering asked. And so I think the new techniques now that they've got for management are really trying to get these sorts of ideals into the people and the systems that are being involved. I think one of the problems that I see now is that it seems like on most of the projects where I've looked recently, you don't have small teams anymore. You have major teams, like teams of 20 and 30 and maybe 40 people trying to bring out a new project. And it is really difficult to get all of these people working together and trying to do the same thing. But I think it's important and essential that they do. Excuse me.
Okay. I'm sure that you engage in a good bit of what would be called professional networking, both within the company and perhaps outside the company during your career. Do you have any particular recollection or comments about that?
Well, certainly as far as inside the company, you develop friendship with an awful lot of people over a career that went as long as mine and the kind of thing that I did. And so I got to know a lot of people, and I used them and vice versa. And that was important. Externally, not really. I probably didn't do nearly as much networking as might have been good for me. I did develop some good friendships on the outside, but a very limited amount.
Mm-hmm. Were there any significant changes in the R&D support during your career?
I don't know what you're
going. Well, was there any upper management decisions that affected the R&D? You indicated, I think, that there's a continual flow of monetary support for your work.
Okay.
But, yes, well, in the early days, in the 50s, Amoco Corporation Chemical Company was formed in 57 as a subsidiary of the Standard Oil. And in the early part of the commercialization of the oxidation technology,
we were losing big amounts of money. And in 1962, Amoco was also trying to, Standard Oil was also trying to develop overseas presence in the oil production and refining area. And they were losing money there too. And I think it was sometime in 62, we got together one day and the vice president said that a third of you are going to be laid off by 4:30 this afternoon, and you'll all know what your position is. And we didn't think too much about it until we got up to the lab, and I was standing there with two of my colleagues, and we said, that's one out of three. And in those days, it wasn't a bad deal because there were lots of job opportunities available for scientists, and most of the people got equal or better positions within 90 days of the time we were laid off. So that was one shot we had, and brought us down to really a very small department, and it was probably the most productive time in my career as far as the department, because we had essentially let go of all the young people and some of the people who weren't producing, so we had really very effective people working in the group. And things pretty well, they didn't go straight then from then on, but you know, gradually up until I guess the late 1980s when restructuring became name of the game. And from then on until now, there have been big decreases in the number of people in the R&D department. Well, we grew at a very rapid rate from 1970 to about 1985. And so we had hired a lot of people. And I have to admit that sometimes we were hiring more people than I thought was logical for the kind of organization we had and for what we were attempting to do. But I guess when management allows you to hire people, you have a tendency to walk into that question too much.
Did most of those hires that you felt might have been excessive stay with the company, or did a downsizing occur subsequently?
Well, a lot of when the downsizing came, it was a lot of it was done by retirement, early retirement, and so on. I guess I don't really know what the percentage, but a lot of people did get let go that we had hired, I thought were. And I don't know enough about the organization right now to know whether, whether they're back into the range. I think they're probably back into the range that I think they should be.
Would you like to pause to get a drink of water?
I think I'll take a cough.
What would you say is important for the future of chemical R&D?
Well, I think probably the most important thing is that they know really what the direction of the organization they're in is going. You need to know what is needed by management and what kind of projects they will really think are great if you are successful. It's my belief that if you told management in a conceptual stage of definition the kind of project you were talking about, that they would not at this stage be willing to support that project. So you have to develop your projects where you think you've got, you need to make some basic, do some basic what I call basic research, getting the understanding, getting the pieces of technology together that would allow for a commercialization. You've got to do that at the as least expensive a way as you can. And get the definition of the technology and work very closely with the marketing people to get the definition of the product pinpointed early in the game. I think the other thing is you've got to recognize what risks your management is going to take. And you always can dream that they're going to take risks outside of the level that they have demonstrated they're willing to take, but it really doesn't happen very often. So you need to know that. And you shouldn't be working on projects, I think, that don't come in with that risk level. The other thing I think is there is a tendency of people to want to commercialize very fast, and I understand that because the sooner you get commercialized, the sooner you start making money. But in doing that, you sometimes spend money up front for development of technology that isn't desirable technology. And then you have to go back and do it over. So I think you need to be very wise at choosing when you've got the right technology to go commercial with. And not put the development money in until you've got that done. I know sometimes you think you've got the right technology and you don't, and that's all right. Because you will make mistakes, you know, if you're not taking risks, if you don't make some mistakes now and then. But I think you need to be working carefully with your marketing and your engineering people to know that you've got all the pieces put in together. That if you're working on a new product, that you've got the right product qualities, properties defined. And one of those qualities is always cost of making the product. So you need to have all those things pretty well understood, and then you need to work on the things that are most important first, and you know, set your priorities straight.
You made some reference to the concerns of the financial persons in the industry about product development. Do you think that given the situation in today's industry that the projects that you successfully worked on would have been approved and supported today in the situation that you found then and now?
Probably not, because we took some what would be considered today big risks, and because we hadn't demonstrated everything, we hadn't dotted every T and crossed every T and dotted every I. Matter of fact, we hadn't even come close. I think, looking back, what made us successful is that we had developed very sound basic understanding of the science that we were working with. We had the physical property data very clearly in hand, and we had the chemical weight data in hand. And with that, and using good, sound chemical engineering judgment, then we were able to take some of these risks, and they did work. They were within close enough proximity that you could adjust. For instance, the DMT process also went directly from these little sealed tubes I was talking to you about to a continuous commercial process without the pilot plant in between. And it turned out that once we finally, I don't know, it was maybe 5 or 6 years after we commercialized the technology, one of our plants actually operated precisely at the rates that we set. Now the thing that kept us from doing that all along was that the catalyst was insoluble and would precipitate out and fill up the reactor, so our reactors would get smaller as we went along, and so we'd have to clean them out every now and then. And that process actually reduced the productivity of the reactors. But I think if you do that, and you ask yourself, "Is what's going to kill you?" and then make sure that you don't have anything in there that'll kill you if you got screwed up, that things will go. But I agree, in this day and age, people would not take the kind of risks that we took.
And yet, that risk, in this case, was very productive. Paid off well.
Yep, that's... Today it's one of Amoco Corporation's major profit makers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly what the percentage of Amoco's profits are that are derived from them, but it's... Enough to affect Wall Street. I saw actually some reference to why Amoco's stock wasn't higher, and they said they were concerned about the price of PTA in the Far East. So if your product, one product can have that kind of an impact on the Wall Street client, I think it does.
Each year, the editor of the New York Times Book Review publishes at year-end a list of the 100 books considered to be most significant that were published during that year. At the end of 1996, just a couple of months ago, the editor included among them a book by John Horgan, The End of Science, it was called. And the one-sentence summary of the book was given, "A bracing argument by a science journalist that the best and biggest discoveries are behind us." What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that's not a loose thought. I kind of remember how many years ago, but it's been maybe 25 years ago that one of our vice presidents from Amoco Oil said that about the science for refining, and then continuous hydroforming came along after that, and we were just lucky we had some technology that worked. I think that the easy discoveries in science are probably have been made. Because discoveries come about by the identification for needs and opportunities. And then once you've got that, you can, the job is, well, it's not simple, but it's relatively easy to get from there to the scientific discovery that feeds those. And so the needs and opportunities have pretty well been identified. So from that standpoint, yes. But I think there are still scientific discoveries that are needed. I know just a few years ago there were needs to improve the speed of computer calculations, and it was dependent on developing the right kind of materials. And they had defined in some general terms those kinds of materials, and people were working very hard at doing that. The volume of those materials wasn't going to be very large in terms of pounds, but if you could do it, you could make a lot of money. And so I think, you know, there are still going to be some inventions made. They're not going to be made in the numbers and the ease with which they were made back then. I think there's some technologies that are producing commercial products now on a large scale that aren't, in my opinion, very good. And there's opportunity for people to improve those technologies. You don't always...
Would you like some coffee?
No, thank you. You don't always know... Whether or not you can do it, but I think there's that it can be done. For instance, butane oxidation of molybdenum hydride is a fairly low chemical yield process, 60-65 mole per cent. there's opportunity for somebody to develop a catalytic system that I think will take that up to 90%. And that would really improve the technology, because basically it's a big heat exchanger, the reactor, because you burn so much as you generate so much heat that you got to get the heat taken out. Whereas if you got the selectivity down, you'd burn a lot less, you'd create a lot less energy from the heat, and it would just be a great improvement all the way around in making that product. There are a few products left like that, but not many. So I agree that a lot of the commercial scientific discoveries have been made, but there's still a lot left. I think one other thing that people like that may forget is that there is a finite supply of oil and gas, and it's probably going to last through the lifetime of most people that are living now. But sometime, maybe by the end of the next century, we may need to make products from stuff other than oil and gas, chemicals. How do you do that from natural products, which is where I think it's going to have to come from? And how do you do it in a way that is not going to totally disrupt the economics of the world at that time? So I think there will be opportunities for scientific discoveries in the future. I can't, you know, you never know exactly what they're going to be or how they're going to come about. But I don't think the last scientific discovery has been made.
You retired from Amoco, I believe, in 92?
Yes.
And you received the Perkin Medal 2 years later.
Yep.
What impact on you did receiving the Perkin Medal have, since it came after your career had terminated?
Well, I was talking to somebody in the past year, I guess, and I said, you know, I said, I really had it fortunate. I said, I got recognized by the company, which is probably nice, because you're recognized by the people that you work for and with and so on, and it's really nice to have that. And then I said, I was recognized by the U.S. government. I said, boy, that's thrilling and exciting. And I was recognized by the college I went to, because they gave me an honorary doctorate degree. And then finally I was recognized by the industry I worked on. And I said, you just can't hardly come off any better than that. You got recognition from everybody that really was important to me in my life. So I think it was a final recognition that was something that I really appreciated.
Certainly a remarkable record of recognition, as well as a remarkable record of industrial achievement that you had.
Thank you.
I would like to ask you, you've made reference a few times in discussions about your family, but tell me more specifically about your family. You have a wife and five children, you said. What are your children doing?
Let's see.
Give me their names and what they're doing.
The oldest son, Kurt, is kind of a computer jack, I guess. He's as near as I understand it, he's a computer programmer now, working on accounting type technologies. My second son has a degree in chemistry and works for it was Union Oil Company, but I'm not sure he's still that, because they're in the process of selling their refinery operations. But anyhow, he's working for that company, selling oil products, lubricating oils and that sort of thing. My third son is a chemical engineer, works for Petrolite Corporation as general manager of their Bayport plant down in Texas. So he's essentially the head of their manufacturing operations, although they do have some in England that he doesn't have responsibility for. And our fourth son, Mike, is an aerospace engineer, works for NASA at Lewis Laboratories in Cleveland. His last responsibility was testing major rocket engines at for Lockheed out at their proving grounds in Sandusky. And our youngest child, a daughter, is teaching school out in California.
High school or
grade school? Yes, freshmen, teaching freshmen and juniors in high school in English.
Well, it sounds as though your family accomplishments merit praise as well as your professional accomplishments. Is there anything else you think of that needs to go on the tape to give a summary of your career?
Well, I think it would be incomplete not to give my wife credit for putting up with me. I had a tendency to get a little emotional about things and worry about them, and she was the person who kept bringing me back to earth when I was too exuberant or down. She was there to level me up, and I think even though she never understood much about chemistry, she always acted like she was interested, even though I think sometimes she was totally bored. And she allowed me to talk on and on about things that were bothering me about.